The North Carolina Reading Service provides this broadcast for a blind and print-impaired audience. It's the Indie Week, and this issue dated September the 29th of 2021. I'm John Federson, reading today, and first an announcement. I have been a bit creative, you may have noticed, about our theme music performers over the past many weeks. So our bosses here today have actually wired me to a polygraph or lie detector to keep me accurate. Well, they haven't actually wired me to a polygraph, so I better get on with our issue today. And as always, recently anyway, my reading today is a combination of the print issue, which is issued the 29th of September, and more recent articles, which actually appear on IndieWeek.com, the online version of the same paper, which have several more articles that I'm beginning to include in this array of news and information. And the first from the print article is called A Stand Sitting by Lee Toss from Raleigh. If righteous indignation could pry open the gates of power, North Carolina NAACP President T. Anthony Spearman would have the pardon for Dante Sharp in his hands by now. For 7 days, the sinewy 70-year-old has sat in a green camping chair and slept in a tent pitched beneath a magnolia tree outside the governor's mansion. He's there in a dogged protest. He tells me from beneath a royal purple cap, his eyes fixed upon the brick and iron gate, I'm taking a stand, sitting. Last Wednesday, Spearman received what would normally be good news, that Governor Roy Cooper intended to pardon Sharp, who was released from prison in 2019 after serving 26 years for murder, for which he's long professed innocence. Sharp was exonerated, but is yet to be pardoned. An official pardon will allow him to seek compensation from the state for wrongful conviction. The pardon application has been received, a spokesman from the governor's office told Indy, noting Cooper has granted 7 pardons of innocence during his tenure. The governor plans to make decisions on this and other cases by the end of the year, said Press Secretary Jordan Monahan. That's not good enough for Spearman, who sees the delay as a politician's gamesmanship. For Spearman, 3 extra months is just more time stolen from Sharp, who was robbed of his youth by a corrupt criminal justice system. So heeding a spiritual call, Spearman vows to remain outside the mansion until Governor Cooper signs the pardon. Slide it under the gate, Spearman shouted during a Friday vigil. Diana Powell, executive director of NC Justice Served, has joined Spearman. The duo plan to continue hosting demonstration outside the mansion every Friday until Sharp receives a pardon. Last week, about 24 residents gathered alongside them for the Freedom Friday protest, listening to Sharp and a phoned-in sermon from the Reverend William Barber II. So far, they've heard nothing from Cooper. We've been getting a little pushback from security, Powell said Monday afternoon. Pretty petty stuff, like having chairs on the sidewalk. Sharp was just 19 in 1994 when he was accused of murdering 33-year-old George Radcliffe in a drug deal gone wrong. Since the beginning, Sharp has maintained his innocence. Expert testimony discredited the prosecution's theory of how the shooting that killed Radcliffe occurred, and Sharp was granted a new trial in 2019. Lacking forensic evidence, Pitt County's district attorney declined to pursue a new trial. For 2 years, Sharp's pardon has collected dust on Cooper's desk. Under state law, once pardoned, he'll be eligible to receive $50,000 for each year spent in prison, up to a maximum of $750,000. Without the pardon, Sharp says he has struggled to find employment. Spearman says he was depressed after learning another North Carolina exoneree, Glenn Edward Chapman, was struggling following his release, according to his family. Chapman served 13 years in prison before he was freed in 2008. When charges against him were dropped. He has also not been granted a pardon yet. His petition has seen three governors in office. Spearman says they deserve to be dignified. I'm tired of it. We need truth, transparency, and accountability, and we need it now. Spearman approached the vigil's portable podium wearing a gray Black Lives Matter sweatshirt. Truth be told, you're all standing in my bedroom, he joked. I'm following the call of the Almighty to be here, and it's not going to be pretty. It's going to be real. Sharp also attended the vigil Friday. He commended a humble presence. He thanked Cooper for the anticipated pardon and told the crowd this wasn't about justice in his case, but addressing a broken criminal justice system. I'm not even worried about me, Sharp says. I'm focused on the guys I left in there. With a simple stroke of a pen, Spearman says Cooper could pardon Sharp today. He does not have to wait, he says. Next, Jasmine Gallup provides an article about the mayor, Mary Ann Baldwin, in Raleigh, called Stalling Out. 5 weeks away from a proposed, 5 weeks away from a self-imposed deadline, a group of neighborhood activists have only about 11% of the signatures needed to trigger a recall election against Raleigh Mayor Mary Ann Baldwin. As days and weeks slip by, it's looking more likely that this effort, like those in years past, will die not with a bang, but a whimper. The campaign to oust Baldwin began this summer by Livable Raleigh, a local activist group critical of the mayor's lack of community engagement and the developer-friendly agenda. The straw that broke the camel's back, however, was the city council's decision to push elections back from next month to November of 2022, buying officials an extra year in office. Successful recall effects are often defined by a single unpopular policy decision, and the decision to postpone those elections was almost universally unpopular. Not only did the council make the dubious choice to push the election, but it did so in secret, earning a censure from Governor Roy Cooper, Wake County's delegation in the state Senate, and hundreds of angry voters. It was the kind of decision that earns condemnation from people on the left and right, a key element to a successful recall, says Mac McCorkle, a professor at Duke University's Sanford School of Public Policy. When it comes to removing someone from office, it's not enough to disagree with their platform, McCorkle told Indy. The few officials who have been recalled are often perceived as betraying those who elected them. He says it has to be a high crime to say you're going to throw somebody out. There has to be a really clear, compelling case, like you aren't who you said you were or you simply can't govern. As a consultant, I would find that a hard case to make. Baldwin has made the case easier to argue. The fact that Raleigh didn't hold open meetings or listen to residents' opinion on the timing is galling, said Bob Hall, co-founder of the Good Government Group, Democracy NC, during a Livable Raleigh event. He says it was just a con job to say that they had to postpone the election in the manner that they did. Respect is at the core of democracy, to not respect your citizens and to not bring them in and ask them and talk to them about such a major policy decision is deplorable. It's clear people are angry, but it likely won't be enough to bring down Baldwin. Since August, some 1,500 people have signed the petition. According to the city's charter, Livable Raleigh needs 14,000 notarized signatures, 25% of the total number of voters who turned out in the last municipal election in 2019. The group has set an October 31st deadline to collect signatures. Although Livable Raleigh Chair Susan Mariama remains optimistic about the chances of earning a recall election, she admits the campaign faces challenges. What we're doing in Raleigh is difficult because it's never been done, Mariama says. It's daunting. Like many cities across the state, Raleigh has high standards for removing lawfully elected officials based on political disagreement. One of the biggest obstacles is the city's, quote, antiquated laws, which don't allow the use of any digital tools to collect signatures, says Mariama. We're required to conduct this recall campaign according to the 1954 city charter rules, she says. It's like being shot back in time. We cannot use any technology to help us, so everything is personal interaction. The coronavirus pandemic creates an additional obstacle since many people are reluctant to join large gatherings. Maniyama and other volunteers have been holding outdoor signing events, but even with safety precautions, people don't really want to get together, she says. Many recall efforts fizzle because of a lack of organization and funding, causing petitioners to fall short of the number of signatures required to force an election. In 1968, for example, an effort by conservatives to recall Durham Mayor Webb Gully died because the petition failed to get enough signatures. Likewise, Baldwin says the recall is led mainly by her political opponents, particularly former city council members Steph Mendel and Russ Stevenson, who lost their bids for re-election in 2019. Baldwin's critics take issue with her pro-development policies, which they say lead to gentrification and displacement. She's also come under fire for her job, with some saying her position as Director of Business Development for Barnhill Contracting represents a conflict of interest. One recall supporter, Steve Mayberry, says, if she stays in power, she'll continue to give kudos to the real estate companies and have things her way. She's not giving full credence to housing needs. Baldwin disagrees, saying her policies are an effort to increase the supply of housing and drive down the cost. She says, what we're trying to do is to build with more density. It's about giving people access to opportunity. Despite the group's determination, it seems unlikely Livable Raleigh's pursuit to recall Baldwin will succeed. Their pro-development grievances aren't supported by all Raleigh residents. While some people find fault with her handling of protests in downtown Raleigh last year and her elimination of citizen advisory councils, there doesn't seem to be enough widespread will for a special election. But even if the effort fails, Livable Raleigh says it has succeeded in drawing attention to a powerful political tool that can be used as a check on executives. During a city council meeting last week, resident Barry Erickson argued in favor of maintaining a viable recall option, especially as elections are moved to even-numbered years when turnout is expected to be much higher. And he said, the recall rules have been outdated for decades. Surely this is an appropriate time to update them. If we are going to switch to four-year terms, we should reform our recall rules to allow a determined effort to recall an elected official to succeed, rather than be stuck with a bad apple in office for a full four-year term. All right, now to September 30th. That's when I'm reading this today, Thursday, an article from the online Indie Week, originally published at NC Policy Watch. State Supreme Court is to consider the possibility of involuntary recusal for Justices Berger and Berenger. The Supreme Court issued an order Tuesday directing the parties in the case of NAACP versus Moore and Berger to submit new briefs addressing questions surrounding the recusal of justices. The order, which the court issued on its own motion, comes in a case in which plaintiffs have moved for two members of the court, Justices Phil Berger Jr. and Tamara Berenger, to voluntarily disqualify or recuse themselves from participation. The order asks the parties to address the procedure the court should use in considering a recusal motion, and then spells out a series of possible questions, including whether the court, quote, has the authority to require involuntary recusal of a justice who does not believe that self-recusal is appropriate. Kim Hunter, a senior attorney at the Southern Environmental Law Center representing the plaintiffs, told Policy Watch in an email, we appreciate the opportunity to provide briefing on this important issue. The integrity of our court system is essential to a fair and just North Carolina. Plaintiffs filed the lawsuit against House Speaker Tim Moore and Senate President Pro Tem Berger Sr. in their official capacities, challenging a pair of constitutional amendments dealing with the subjects of voter ID and the state income tax cap. These amendments were approved by the General Assembly in 2018, placed on that November's ballot, and ultimately approved by a majority of voters. The voter ID amendment requires voters to present a photo ID from an approved list for in-person voting. The tax cap amendment lowered the state's maximum personal income tax rate from 10 to 7%. The plaintiffs argued that the amendments must be found unconstitutional because they were approved and placed on the ballot by lawmakers who were elected from legislative districts that were determined by a federal court to have been unlawfully gerrymandered. In addition to the amendments themselves, the case could determine the fate of the statute implementing the voter ID amendment that lawmakers enacted over a gubernatorial veto during a lame duck session that took place after Republicans lost their veto-proof supermajorities in the General Assembly in the 2018 election. Earlier this month, a divided Superior Court panel found that law unconstitutional in the case Holmes et al. Versus Moore et al., holding that, quote, the Republican majority in passing SB 824 targeted voters who, based on race, were unlikely to vote for the majority party. Moore's office has indicated that lawmakers would appeal the decision. As Policy Watch previously reported, the NAACP versus Moore and Berger case arrived at the High Court after a three-judge panel of the State Court of Appeals reversed a lower court ruling in the plaintiff's favor. Once at the Supreme Court, plaintiffs moved for Justices Phil Berger, Jr. and Tamara Berenger to recuse themselves from the case because Berger, Jr.'s connections with his father, a named defendant, and Berenger's previous service in the state Senate, where she voted to approve the challenged amendments in 2018. Berger and Berenger, both Republicans, won election to the state Supreme Court in 2020. The North Carolina Code of Judicial Conduct requests judges' recusal when an individual within 3 degrees of relationships is a party to a case. Ellen Murphy, a professor teaching legal ethics at Wake Forest Law School, said the state code of judicial conduct makes it clear that Berger Jr. should recuse himself due to the obvious conflict of interest. She emphasized that judges and justices need to act in a way that promotes public confidence in the impartiality of the judiciary, saying, the authority of a court comes from the perspective of the public. So when we analyze this from the lens of the public sees a father and son, and they see that impartiality is not possible. Murphy added that without Berger's recusal, the plaintiff's rights to a fair and impartial trial could be impaired. And she said, plaintiffs shouldn't have to pay the price for the fact that you have a father and son who are in these two roles that creates a conflict of interest. In Tuesday's order, the Supreme Court authorized the parties to submit briefs within 30 days that would address a variety of questions related to such matters as involuntary recusal practices in federal courts and courts of other states, the court's authority and enforcement mechanism of involuntary recusal, the Supreme Court's past practices for recusal decisions, differences between a Supreme Court justice recusal and that of a trial court judge or lower appellate judge, whether the justices who are the object of the recusal motion should participate in ruling on it, and the effect of justices' duty to sit on a recusal decision, whether written rules should be adopted to govern the recusal of a Supreme Court justice, and whether any rules adopted should incorporate a process for making findings of fact, what proof is needed, and who should bear the burden of proof. Murphy said, by seeking input from defendants and plaintiffs, the state Supreme Court is asking substantive questions that, quote, highlight the complicated nature of involuntary recusal in our self-regulated profession. The oral argument for NAACP versus Moore was originally scheduled for late August. In the absence of a response from either justice to the recusal motion, the Supreme Court pulled the case from the calendar shortly before the scheduled hearing. Democrats hold a slight advantage of 4-3 on the state's highest court. Any recusal, including the disqualification of any justice in determining whether to impose an involuntary recusal, could have a significant bearing on the results of the case. This case could also set a precedent for cases involving Berger Sr. as a legislative defendant in the future. Currently, pending in the Supreme Court is another case, Community Success Initiative versus Moore and Berger, in which appellant plaintiffs are asking the Supreme Court to reverse a Court of Appeals ruling and uphold a lower court ruling to allow those with felony convictions to vote if they are serving parole, probation, and post-release supervision. That article was written for NC Policy Watch by Young Pete Zhu, and Greg Childress from the same issue talks about the Leandro mandate for state schools. Flush with cash, the state of North Carolina owes its children nothing less than a fully funded Leandro comprehensive remedial plan. The Governor's Commission on Access to a Sound Basic Education unanimously agreed on Tuesday. The Commission made its statement in a resolution urging, quote, state bodies, entities, and agencies to take all necessary actions to implement the plan, which outlines steps the state must take to meet its constitutional obligation to ensure that students have access to sound basic education. Governor Cooper, who attended the early part of the virtual meeting, says, we have a once-in-a-generation opportunity to use our state's resources to truly transform and strengthen our public schools. Our state has the resources to live up to our constitutional obligation to our children, and now is the time to do it. Jeffrey Coltrane, the governor's senior education advisor, noted that economists in the Office of State Budget and Management and the General Assembly's Fiscal Research Division released a consensus revenue forecast in June that anticipates an additional $6.5 billion in state revenue through the next biennium. The remedial plan calls for $691 million in additional education spending this year and $1.1 billion next year. The full plan will cost $5.6 billion in recurring K-12 funding and $3.6 million in non-recurring funding through 2028. The seven-year plan includes money for teacher raises, expanding North Carolina pre-K programs, and additional money for low-wealth school districts, among other items. Coltrane said, we do have the resources available to implement the next 2 years of the plan. We're very fortunate as a state to be in a strong fiscal position. Commission Chairman Brad Wilson said the comprehensive research-based plan would provide all students with the opportunity to receive a sound basic education. And he said, it's both a constitutional and moral imperative that our state ensures that the comprehensive remedial plan is fully implemented and that we allocate the resources necessary to get that done. The commission's meeting took place as Cooper, a Democrat, and leaders of the Republican-controlled General Assembly appeared to begin to work in earnest toward a budget compromise. Cooper said the commission's support will be critical during budget negotiations, saying, we know it'll be difficult because we've seen comments made by certain legislators, but what I do know is there seems to be a real willingness now to negotiate in good faith as we move forward. Cooper said he doesn't know if the negotiations will last days or weeks. He pledged to fight for items in the plan. And he said, as we enter these new trilateral budget negotiations, I will work as hard as I can for strong investments in this plan so that we can make it a reality. We have a transformational opportunity here. We have the funding. The commission's meeting took place as Superior Court Judge David Lee's deadline for state leaders to say how much they will pay for the remedial plan fast approaches. Earlier this month, Lee, the judge overseeing the landmark Leandro School funding case, signaled he's ready to take action if the General Assembly doesn't come up with a design for funding by October 15. He scheduled a hearing for October 18 to discuss the next step if agreement on such a plan has not been reached. Lee said, partially paraphrasing the words of a song used by one of his favorite country singers, Vince Gill, I'm giving the legislative and executive branches one more last chance before they say we're through. That's not to threaten anybody. It's to send a clear signal, clear as I know how, that come October 18th, if this hasn't already been addressed, as it should be addressed, as the court find it needs to be addressed, we will certainly be prepared to address it. Governor Cooper's budget proposal fully funds the first 2 years of this remedial plan. It would allocate $7.25 million in fiscal year 21-2 and $1.15 billion in 22-3. Both the House and Senate proposals, however, allocate sums that are woefully short of that nearly $1.7 billion the architects of the plan say is needed to pay for the first 2 years of the plan. The Senate's proposal includes just $191.6 million in the first year, $213.7 million in the second. Meanwhile, the House proposal would appropriate $370 million and $382 million, respectively. The Leandro case began more than a quarter century ago after five rural school districts in low-wealth counties sued the state, arguing they couldn't raise the tax revenue needed to provide students with quality education. In 1997, the state Supreme Court issued a ruling, later reconfirmed in 2004, in which it held that every child has a right to, quote, sound basic education that includes competent and well-trained teachers and principal, and equitable access to resources. Commissioner Rick Glazier, a former state representative and current executive director of the North Carolina Justice Center, noted that all the pieces are in place for state lawmakers to act on the remedial plan. The state has a constitutional mandate to provide children with a sound basic education. A consent judgment has been entered by the court, and the state has conceded that North Carolina is not meeting its mandate. A comprehensive plan to achieve constitutional minimums are in place, and ample money exists to pay for the first 2 years, Glazer said. He said the state must comply with Lee's order. Quote, this is not a discretionary task unless we believe the Constitution to be nullity, and it clearly is not. It is the law and applies to all of us in the state, including the three branches of government. The state has a responsibility, obligation, and a judgment it must comply with. Leaders of the Republican-controlled General Assembly has been generally dismissive of Lee's orders and his threats to force them to pay for the plan. Pat Ryan, an aide to Senate leader Phil Berger, told Raleigh's News and Observer earlier this month, I don't know how much clearer we can be. If Judge Lee wants to help decide how to spend state dollars, a role that has been the exclusive domain of the legislative branch since the state's founding, then Judge Lee should run for a seat in the House or Senate. That's where the Constitution directs state budgeting decisions be made, not some county trial judge. As Policy Watch reported in July, there are multiple examples in other states in which courts have forced reluctant legislatures to adequately fund K-12 education. In 2015, for example, the Washington State Supreme Court held the state in contempt and fined it $100,000 per day after it failed to come up with a plan to adequately fund K-12 education, as required by a 2012 court order. The fine came after threats of sanctions if lawmakers did not live up to what that state's constitution called a paramount duty to amply fund schools in that state. Lee said he's aware of such actions, and he said on September 8th, I've read some of the things that have happened in Kansas, Washington State, and some of the others that have similar constitutional provisions, but I'm not prepared to shine a light on that this morning. I will be prepared to shine a light on that on October the 18th. Another reprint article now from NC Health News, published again, republished in Indy Week, by Nadia Batul Bokhari. Global pandemic, Afghan refugees in North Carolina face a challenging health care system. Azita Razai has lived in Raleigh for the past 24 years, making a home with her husband, mother, and three children. Her journey to North Carolina from her native Afghanistan more than two decades ago included a stop in Pakistan before arriving in this country as a refugee. Like many of the refugees coming here today, she fled the Taliban in her home country. Her memories of leaving her Kabul home are still painfully fresh. Her family left there with little more than the clothes they could carry. Conditions were difficult. Now in North Carolina, more than two decades later, Razai has been reminded of her time in those camps and her early days in this state. Since the U.S. military pulled out of Afghanistan last month, roiling the country at the crossroads of Asia again, North Carolina and other states have been preparing for a swell of Afghan refugees. Those who end up in North Carolina will arrive in a state where the Delta variant of SARS-CoV-2 rages. They will face this global public health threat while also learning to navigate a very different health system that's challenging to understand, even for people who are from here. North Carolina is expecting 1,169 Afghan refugees in the coming month, according to the Associated Press, and Razai is gathering contributions to help them. It's part of her job with Lutheran Services, Carolinas, where she works as an interpreter and translator. She was hired weeks ago to be an assistant case manager for the agency to help with the resettlement of families coming to this state. Her own experiences will help guide her in coaching a new generation of Afghan refugees through the complexities of the new systems and bureaucracies that they will encounter during the difficult times of starting anew in a strange land. The healthcare system in Afghanistan is vastly different from the American one. World Health Organization, or WHO, cautioned on September 22nd that a system that had grown fragile in recent years was on the verge of collapse. Much of the international aid that had been flowing into the country before the Taliban took over the government has been held back in recent weeks by countries and organizations and unsure about the new regime. Even before the Taliban takeover, there were disparities in healthcare access for residents in the metropolitan regions and rural provinces of Afghanistan, even more pronounced than similar disparities in North Carolina. In 2018, according to a WHO report, there were 3,100 functional healthcare facilities, ensuring that nearly 87% of the country had access to care within a two-hour drive from their home. There are government hospitals and emergency care centers where residents have to pay very little to get in line for care. Many lack the latest advances in medical technology, and some are not as clean as healthcare centers in the U.S., Razai said. There are also private clinics and hospitals that charge patients more. Doctors who work at government facilities sometimes moonlight at the private care centers, which pay more, and they set different rates for procedures and treatments. Health insurance is a foreign concept in Afghanistan. That won't be the case for refugees in North Carolina. They will find a healthcare system that requires mounds of paperwork and can seem almost prohibitive to access without Medicaid and Medicare, the government-based insurance plans, or private insurance plans that employers often supplement. In this country, the type of health care a person receives is often too closely tied to their income and personal wealth. Because many of the refugees had to leave much behind and may not immediately find high-paying jobs, Razai predicts that health care access will be a huge challenge for the incoming Afghan refugees. Emily Esmaili is a pediatrician who works at Lincoln Community Health Center in Durham. In late August, Durham Mayor Steve Shule said the city already had welcomed several Afghan refugee families and looked forward to having many more settle there in the coming months. Lincoln Community Health pediatrician Emily Esmaili said her organization is getting ready to help them. In a recent interview, she said workers at Lincoln Center didn't know how many refugees were coming to North Carolina. Primary care providers at Lincoln will likely be informed 24 to 48 hours prior to refugees' arrival. She said her clinic will provide temporary Medicaid to the Afghan refugees, which may last between 6 and 9 months. But that could be complicated, since many are arriving in this country as evacuees, unable to get the assistance typically provided to refugees through the Federal Department of Health and Human Services, according to the Associated Press. The Biden administration has asked Congress to act to make the new arrivals eligible for such assistance. Nonetheless, Lincoln has a low-cost pharmacy where refugees in the Durham area could get medicines they might need. Lincoln does not offer different financial assistance programs beyond a sliding fee scale based on income. When the short-term Medicaid benefits end, the refugees can reapply for the program. If they meet the requirements for Medicaid, they will get it again. In July, North Carolina had about 90 refugee Medicaid recipients, but by September, that number had grown to 149 people. Esmaili, the daughter of Iranian immigrants, says she can easily understand the language barrier and some of the cultural barriers that the refugees will have to face. She's also treated other refugees at Lincoln before. For those who don't speak English, the clinic sometimes has had to get help from resettlement agencies to arrange interpretation for a particular language. As Miley said, "We have access to a phone interpreter system that is able to reach interpreters from across the nation, and while it is often difficult to find interpreters of the rarer languages." Rod Jenkins, director of the Durham County Department of Public Health, said his staff was ready to welcome the refugees, but he did not know the precise number for how many are coming to Durham. He said he's heard from different sources that between 60 to 150 families were coming. Many of the Afghan refugees were flown to Dulles International Airport. The Federal Emergency Management Agency set up a COVID vaccination site nearby and offered the refugees the single-dose Johnson & Johnson vaccine, according to news reports. By the time refugees arrive in Durham and other places across North Carolina, Jenkins said, they should already be vaccinated against COVID in Virginia. If not, he added, we will always welcome everyone to get vaccinated without any type of discrimination like race, nationality, religion, color. Some of the Afghan refugees likely to arrive in North Carolina are from the minority Hazara community. Hazaras are 15 to 20% of the total population of Afghanistan, and they are Shia Muslims, whereas most Afghani Muslims are Sunni. Many of the Hazaras, who highly prize education and have a higher literacy rate than most other Afghanis, worked as translators, cooks, drivers, and other service positions for the U.S. military. Those relationships have put them at risk. In addition, sectarian differences meant the community was targeted by the Taliban during their prior time in power. Their language is Hazargi, and many do not understand Pashto, Dari, or Persian, the other languages spoken in Afghanistan. Razai said that in North Carolina there are few Hazaragi language interpreters. Jenkins says his department will access a language line to translate refugees' health problems. But he said, we don't have any type of program to hire short-term or permanent Afghan refugees interpreters for our system. And finally, in this article, do you want to help? Razai wrote in a WhatsApp message, any help is always accepted, such as groceries, gift cards, linens, and other household items, baby formula, new baby items or gently used toiletries and kitchen items. Also, halal restaurants gift cards will be perfect. How can you contribute? Contact Lutheran Services Carolinas in Raleigh. Call this number, 1-800-HELPING, 1-800-HELPING. If you wish to volunteer, contact volunteer@lscarolinas.net. That's lscarolinas.net. Or donate to Refugee Services. Back to the print edition now. Olivia Olscher reports on Durham mayoral candidate Charlotta Burris. banking on boots-on-the-ground experience. As mayoral candidate, Charlotta Burris showed us around her neighborhood, Edgemont Elms. She stopped at the road in front of her house and pointed to the ground, where bullet shells had strewn the street the night before. "I picked up 15 shells from this parking lot," said Burris, shaking her head. Having served on the resident councils of several Durham Housing Authority communities, she previously lived in Calvert Place, Burris is familiar with the gun violence and affordable housing crises facing the city. Through her campaign, Burris hopes to encourage others from low-income neighborhoods to run for political office. She said people like her, who have relationships with residents of Durham's often overlooked communities, have an important perspective to share. And she told the Ninth Street Journal, "We don't consider people who are actually boots on the ground, that are actually in the community and making a big impact." By the way, this is the Ninth Street Journalist, published by journalism students at Duke University, Center for Media and Democracy. It was a partnership between them and the Indy for this article. In June this year, after hearing gunfire every night from her home in Edgemont Elms, she organized a community barbecue, inviting district police and local families to spend time together and build relationships. In addition to her resident council responsibilities, Burris is a member of the Residential Advisory Board of DHA and chairperson for the Consumer Family Advisory Committee of Durham. DHA, by the way, Durham Housing Authority. In 2018, she received a Neighborhood Spotlight Award for her community outreach effort in Durham, which included organizing food and toy donations and community events. This campaign marks Burris' fourth attempt at running for political office in North Carolina. She was a candidate for mayor of Monroe in 2007, town council in Marshville in 2011, and city council in Durham in 2019, receiving 1,258 votes. Born in Washington, D.C., in 1959, Burris comes from a family of preachers. After working many different jobs to support her son, Burris decided to pursue higher education in her late 40s. Receiving an associate's degree in human services from South Piedmont Community College in 2004, and a Bachelor of Science in Social Work from Gardner-Webb University in 2006. Though she has never held a political office, Burris is an experienced community leader. She said her roots in the community give her an advantage over other candidates. For example, Burris has become frustrated by what she sees as broken communication channels between DHA residents and local government officials. In her experience, the local government makes a dangerous presumption that all DHA residents have access to computers and internet required to find information about affordable housing and employment opportunities. She says Durham officials don't realize not everybody can afford internet access, and older people are not using computers. She said alternative methods of communications like electronic billboards and posters containing updates from the local government could be a better way to reach those without internet access. Patching these communication gaps between low-income residents and the Durham mayor's office is a vital prerequisite to addressing the issues she is most passionate about: crime, affordable housing, and employment. Addressing crime and poverty would be Burris's main priority as mayor. She believes investment in education and parental support in communities with high crime rates can help break this cycle. Burris does not support defunding the police in Durham. Rather, she believes police officers should be retrained to better communicate with residents and those with mental health conditions. She also supports paying police officers more so they don't leave to find work in counties, offering higher salaries. She says her experience as a liaison between local residents, police, and the housing authority positions her well to improve city relations as mayor. If elected, Burris plans to spend time in Durham speaking to people on the ground to inform her policy decisions. And she says, "If I were in the mayor's chair, you'd be able to put your hands on me." Another campaign article, now from Chapel Hill. Hannah Olson interviews Alan Buansi, who is going to run for the retiring Verla Inskos District 56, North Carolina House seat. When Alan Buansi was in seventh grade, bored in the way that only middle schoolers can be, he found his purpose in the pages of history books, reading about black leaders making strides in both civil rights and politics. He recalls, "I was lounging around the house, and my mother catches me doing that, and she said, 'Alan, why don't you start reading some books?'" He read about Shirley Chisholm, the first African-American congresswoman, Thurgood Marshall, former Supreme Court Justice, and Charles Houston, the architect of the NAACP legal strategy against Jim Crow laws. Once he was inspired and says, "My mom encouraged me to think about what I want to do with my life and what my calling was. I gravitated toward this idea of public service, advocating for folks who are in need. These folks were operating at a time when things were really bleak, especially for black people, especially for women. And yet they saw fit to do whatever they could to move that ball forward. I wanted to fight for people. I want to do what I can to make life equitable." Fast forward a couple of decades, and now with a UNC Chapel Hill law degree under his belt, Buansi has worked as a civil rights and municipal lawyer and is serving his first term on the Chapel Hill Town Council. In an exclusive interview with Indy, Buansi laid out his plans to run for the North Carolina State House seat vacated by Representative Verla Inskos pending retirement. Though inspired in middle school, Buansi says he didn't recognize the power local governments have to effect change until he interned at the Center for Civil Rights at UNC Chapel Hill. There, he learned more about the continuing legacy of Jim Crow in North Carolina and how local governments can either be actors promoting discrimination or working to end it. He says, "I had this newfound appreciation for the power that local government can have for actively dismantling systems of exclusion. What can I be doing at this point to promote equity right here in my own community?" In 2017, after taking a full-time attorney position at the Civil Rights Center and working as policy director on Attorney General Josh Stein's successful campaign, Buansi decided it was time to run for office. Elected to the Chapel Hill Town Council in 2017, Buansi will serve only one term, ending in December. He recently welcomed twin boys with his wife, Sarah, a professor in UNC Chapel Hill's Department of Family Medicine. He told Indy in July that his decision not to run stemmed from the time commitment it takes to mount a campaign, which would pair poorly with caring for two newborns. As Insko won't leave her seat until December of 2022, Buansi figures he's bought some time. His council seat is one of four up for election this year. During his time on the council, Buansi's led several initiatives, including a criminal justice debt program, a poet laureate program, affordable housing projects, and a community initiative to reimagine public safety. Reflecting on the past 4 years, Buansi says he is proudest of his work with fellow council member Karen Stegman on the criminal justice debt program and his efforts to reform local policing and assistance facilitated by the council during the COVID pandemic. Buansi and Stegman worked to establish a debt fund to assist nonviolent offenders living in poverty and trying to better their lives. The fund is designed to help town residents pay high court fees and costs. Stegman says Buansi is, quote, "deeply committed to public service, a thoughtful and measured policymaker who listens, honors different perspectives, and approaches his role with respect and humility." She wrote in an email, "He unfailingly centers equity and fairness, informed both by his experiences growing up in Chapel Hill, as well as his work as a civil rights attorney. During his time in the council, Alan has been a fierce champion for those historically underrepresented in our local government, bringing their voices forward powerfully and with authority. If not for his commitment to collaboration and ability to bring clarity as to what is at stake, our joint efforts would likely not have been successful." Councilmember Michael Parker echoed these sentiments, calling Buansi a truly effective member of the council, he told the Indy. His ability to work and collaborate with the other members of council has led him to having an important impact in the town's response to the George Floyd murder, creation of a criminal justice debt relief fund, and making sure that the voices of those who have underrepresented and marginalized are heard. His voice and leadership on council will be missed. Following Floyd's murder, Bouancy spearheaded a resolution reimagining community safety, calling for some short and long-term changes to policing in Chapel Hill. Two immediate changes, one prohibiting law enforcement officers from using chokeholds as a police tactic, and another that prohibits low-level traffic regulatory stops, will be crucial in alleviating the focus and burdens of policing on poor people. In the long term, the Reimagining Community Safety Task Force will study public safety through the lens of accessibility, as well as policing, over the next year. If elected to the General Assembly, Bouancy will have some big shoes to fill. Insko, who announced this month she would retire at the end of her term, is one of the longest-serving Democrats in the state legislature. She's held her seat for 24 years, or, as she put it, before the iPhone was invented. Jonah Garson, an attorney and former chair of the Orange County Democratic Party, announced he is stepping down from that role to run for Insko's seat in the House, according to a report from Chapel Borough, and confirmed to the Indy by Garson's campaign manager. Bouancy, a Chapel Hill native, recalls growing up and looking to Insko as a role model. He says, "I would be committed to carrying on that mantle, that legacy. I got to admire her from afar, and as I've grown older, especially when I was elected to the town council, I've gotten to work with her in a different type of capacity and see her work ethic and values up close and personal. The kind of legacy that she's created is one of empathy, of a dogged pursuit of fairness and equality and equity." Bouancy says if elected, he will approach the role as an opportunity to bring local issues to the statewide stage. Quote, "It's a real opportunity to take the work that we've been doing in Chapel Hill to the state level, work that is centered on making our state and community more affordable, accessible, inclusive through the state legislature." Bouancy says his main priorities include addressing climate change, public education, and affordable health care. "Environmental justice is also on the front burner," he says. Quote, "I've got a track record as a leader. I've done a lot of work on the ground as an activist. I feel I have a lot to bring to the table, and I'm here to serve our people, our district, and all of North Carolina." From the arts pages of Indie Week Now, a music article by Madeline Crone about Mac McGowan, or McGowan. "Most people can recall the feeling of a momentary cringe when hearing their own voice resounding through a foreign body. A video playback or a conference call echo can induce a disassociative shudder and the age-old question, 'That's what my voice sounds like?' According to musician Mac McGowan, this phenomenon doesn't get easier. Even after 12 Superchunk albums and another 6 with Portastatic. On his new solo album, The Sound of Yourself, the dynamic musician and Merge label co-founder explores this phenomenon with veteran poise. Released September 24 via Merge Records, McGowan's third solo effort contains boundless self-expression, spurred by the silence of a global pandemic and supported by an impressive cast and dear friends and career-long collaborators. The album concept came to him on one of those lockdown walks that McGowan, like many, took for the sake of sanity last spring. On a walk through the woods, he was listening to a recording of Amy Rigby reading her memory, Girl to City. He says, "She was talking about how if you're someone who plays a guitar and sings, but you're used to just playing in your room or apartment, the first time you hear your voice come out of like a monitor on stage or recorded in the studio, it's different. Maybe it's weird something, sounding or not as natural as you thought." Struck by this idea, the indie rocker got to work on what would become a deeply personal project. Until this point, he'd had no formal conception of what this project would be, beyond the simple fact that he wanted to make an album this year. As the label head overseeing 2021 release plans for much of his roster, which includes artists like His Golden Messenger, The Mountain Goats, Y Oak, and more, he worked within a two-month window to record and mix the new music, wrapping up in record time. To discover the depth of his own voice, McGowan kicked aside some of his characteristic indie rocker elements that might clutter the vocal centerpieces. An intentional sparseness evokes an ethereal soundscape throughout the LP. He says, "One thing I'm always trying to do, and I'm not always successful, is slow down and allow more space to exist in the songs. I tend to kind of rush things, whether it's the tempo of a song or just the fact I'm always anxious to hear a finished recording." The title track is exemplary of this new intentionality. McGowan had shaped the sounds for that song in his head, and when inspiration finally struck, he crafted lyrics around the title, "The Sound of Yourself." Starts with a sparseness induced by the lulling drum machine and a hypnotic bass line. He says, "Even when things come in, they come in incrementally and texturally, rather than, here's this guitar solo to listen to now." He likens this project to an early Portastatic record. Unlike his previous solo work, The Sound of Yourself showcases a pioneering spirit through instrumental tracks and a process he describes as more all over the place. "This album is me trying to incorporate randomness and accidents and end up with something that still sounds balanced and not totally out of whack, but with enough weird things left in there to feel human," he adds. Well, our music creeps in, making me cut this article, unfortunately, quite short. Again, that was Mac McGowan. Important articles from Indie Week and IndieWeek.com that I wasn't able to get to was a sandwich shop called Ideal Sandwich and Grocery, a Slingshot Moog Fest, music festival, and a new documentary following falconers across the world to new heights. The Eyes of Tammy Faye, a movie. And there's also a few other articles. And I will, John Feddersen, now returning you to your regular programming and saying that this broadcast will be available as a podcast, as it is, at ncreadingservice.org. Thanks for listening to Indie Week. Bye-bye.